Welcome, welcome. I am Juma, and this is Leaf Style, where education, culture, and cannabis collide. We have a great show today. Looking forward to speaking with Nyambi McIntosh. But first, I would love to introduce our distinguished co-host, Dr. Lynn, a medical cannabis and emergency medicine physician, and the founder of Ask Dr. Lynn. How are you, Dr. Lynn?
I am great, Juma. Happy New Year. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. Juma is our resident sociologist, attorney, and all-around global citizen, and it is a pleasure to be on this platform today working with you and the beautiful Nyambi McIntosh. Let's introduce our guest. So, Nyambi, over the last several years, you are the youngest child of 10, and an activist and the revolutionary musician, Mr. Peter Tosh. You have brought his platform to light, and you have done so much to carry your father's message across the world. As a Renaissance woman yourself, you've served many roles, including head of Peter Tosh's legacy and brand managing member of Tosh Holdings, including board chairperson for Peter Tosh Foundation, and including the president of the PT Capital LLC. Not to mention your work in Boston with the children and the education system and everything you've done to really promote the message of his legacy and making sure that the family continues to remain bold and prominent in his statement and carry out his words of wisdom. Welcome to our platform today. Welcome to Leaf Style.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Juma and Dr. Lynn, for having me. It's a pleasure to be on Leaf Style today.
Yes. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. Always kick off our interviews starting the same with everyone. And our question is, how did you get introduced to cannabis?
Cannabis has really been a part of my culture, you know, for many years. I was born in Jamaica and raised in Boston. My father was a follower of Rastafari, and even coming to Boston with my Boston side of the family, many of them adopted, you know, the Rastafari spirituality. And so cannabis is just always been around. And then my father sung the song Legalize It. And so growing up hearing that song, it's was kind of something that was always just around and playing. But as I got older, I realized its true significance when I started to hear like colleges and Harvard professors start to like actually recognize some of the claims that my father was making in the song about its medicinal benefits. So it's really just been since my existence,
since
been
existence.
Around since my existence.
And speaking of that, you know, your father, Peter Tosh, is one of the founding fathers of this cannabis legalization movement. And speak to a little bit about the legacy of that song, Legalize It. It's such a revolutionary statement in 1976, still today. But speak a little bit about that song in itself and that part of the legacy and in the cannabis legalization movement.
Yeah, definitely. So my father was a founding member of the Wailers, and that's Bob Marley, you know, Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer, and then started his solo career in 1975 with the Legalize It album. It was actually banned in Jamaica mm-hmm. in 1975, and it wasn't released in the United States until 1976. And so, you know, he faced opposition, you know, it wasn't something that came easy, but he faced opposition from day one. And if anyone Googles him today, you know, you'll see him with a spliff in his mouth on, no matter where he is, like on stage, you know, in a car driving. I've heard stories of him, you know, doing radio interviews. I've heard stories of him, you know, turning down interviews or, you know, studio interviews just because he's like, look, this is what I believe in. And if you can't accept me and my spliff, then that's just going to be what it is. But he's also faced, you know, police brutality for it as well and has been targeted countless times by the police in Jamaica. And so he was a man that, you know, fought for what he believed in it. And really, it didn't come easy, but he continued to advocate for it throughout his life.
Let's speak about Bob Marley and yes. Peter Tosh's personal relationship. And from the teaching of the guitar to finally leaving the group and starting his solo career, did he tell you a lot about that wisdom and that relationship and how they grew as artists and as friends?
You know, my father passed away in 1987, and I'm 40, so I was only 5 years old at the time when he passed. And so a lot of the stories that I have are from people that have known him and were around during those times of the Wailers and part of his band when he had his solo career. And I've always, you know, he's, even in interviews, you know, he's said that they were brothers, you know, from day one. And even when he started his solo career, he made a point to never say like the Wailers broke up, because he's always felt that connection to them, to Bob and Bunny Wailer. But a lot of people didn't really think that he, or know that he was the kind of musically inclined one in the band. He knew how to play over like 20 plus instruments. And so he came into the Wailers knowing how to play the guitar, and Bob and Bunny were really just vocalists. And so he sat and taught them over time how to play the guitar, not only Bob, but many musicians in Jamaica, which I recently found out, which I thought was pretty interesting. So they've always kept a bond, and even though he ventured off into his solo career, he still felt connected, you know, to him as a brother.
Right. Right. And speaking of that, was there, from your understanding, what was the thing that kind of drove your father sort of to leave the Wailers? Was there any role there? And I'm just curious, because I, you know, doing the research, it's Chris Blackwell and Island Records. Was there any role there in sort of his departure from the Wailers?
Definitely. The Wailers were originally just the Wailers. And it wasn't until Chris Blackwell came along when he kind of created that divide and made it Bob Marley and the Wailers. And so my father never, you know, joined the band to be a background vocalist. You'll hear him say this in interviews. And he just knew it was time for him to really spread his message. You know, he had a very political voice, and Chris Blackwell was more about, like, you know, the more softer, easier toned reggae, One Love, and things of that nature. And so, but it was, you know, get up songs like Get Up Stand Up, and you know, Equal Rights and Justice, Apartheid. These are songs that my father really wanted to be known for and promote. He was an activist, you know, in his music, and that was a message that Chris Blackwell really didn't support. So he had to kind of break free in order to really find his voice and share his message.
Right. And speaking of that a little bit about that message, and obviously dedicated to Rastafarianism and Pan-Africanism, is it also accurate to say that your father was the one that really introduced Bob and Bunny to Rastafarianism and sort of more of a radical approach, activist approach in the music?
I wouldn't say it was my father that introduced them to it. And I've been doing a lot of learning now, and they all, would learn from, you know, different local Rastas in Jamaica. So there was a time when they had like shaved heads, and then there was a transition when everybody in the group went Rasta. And it was really from other Rastas within the elders, you know, within the community that really passed on that knowledge. They were pro-Black. They knew about, you know, the Black Panther Party. My father was one of the most well-read. And so even when he wrote the song Apartheid, back in 1970, 78, many of his band members thought that he made up a word. You know, they were just like, oh, this is just one of Peter's, you know, charismatic words that he's making up. So he was a lot more worldly knowledgeable, I would say, than the rest of the Wailers, and often learning, you know, self-taught with a lot of Pan-Africanist education. and just education overall.
Let's speak about the legacy of Peter and the actual foundation and Peter Tosh Day. I want to learn a little bit more about the foundation and it's bring us up to speed on what's been going on with all the work you've been doing.
Yeah, definitely. I actually took over the estate actually within the last, 10, 12 years or so. It was 2010. And so although he had passed away in 1987, it wasn't until, 10 years ago where the family realized this was a legacy that was ours to really carry on. And so, shortly after that, we founded the Peter Tosh Foundation in 2016. And it was very important that as part of our literal foundation of the legacy that, his message and work be a part of what we do. And so now we have the Peter Tosh Foundation. We have five core initiatives, legalize it being one of them, making sure that we can advocate for legalization education, cannabis education, Rastafari, but also we have partnerships with like Minorities for Miracle Marijuana and doing expungement clinics around the country. We also have an initiative called Equal Rights and Justice, and it's really looking to partner with different organizations and communities to promote that message. There is also the Can't Blame the Youth initiative, and I'm an educator. I've been an educator for, I've retired since, but I've been in education for about 10 years. And so, bridging that gap between the original fans that, were with him and at his concerts in, the 70s and 80s to now educating a younger generation about his impact and the power of music and the message in our music and everything that he's really stood for and advocated for is all where we have a bunch of different, initiatives that really just continue to plant those seeds, in the next generation and many people that, aren't aware of who he is and the various messages in his music.
Let's talk about sort of the awareness of your father. Again, we hear so much about Bob Marley, the Wailers, but your father has a global audience. And this is, all over the world, the Peter Tosh name is very popular and known. Can you talk a little bit about continually trying to bring that legacy to light, as well as what you're trying to do around Peter Tosh Day 420 and sort of that yes. sort of movement there?
Yeah, so it was a few years ago where as the head of the estate, I grew up knowing that 420 was kind of this day where many cannabis enthusiasts really celebrated cannabis consumption. And so just a few years ago, I just was like, I think this day belongs to us. I'm self-proclaiming this day as International Peter Tosh Day, because it's what better time to really recognize his contribution to cannabis culture, to cannabis legalization and the movement and his sacrifice. And so since 2014 is when we had our inaugural International Peter Tosh Day. And now, we've been celebrating every year in various ways with partnerships. We do work with our nonprofit and different partners, but also making sure that we continue to educate people that now have the luxury of legalized cannabis, but often don't know, how far it has come and who are the forefathers that made this legalization happen and who are those that have sacrificed. And my father, with his music, particularly, Legalize It being a platinum selling album and, even the album cover, he's in the middle of a cannabis field. Before this album was released, people haven't even seen that before. So it's his legacy on International Peter Tosh Day is really to continue to do what I do. And it was another opportunity that I think was necessary for the brand and his name to be a part of.
Right. Absolutely. And speaking of that, is you spoke about sacrifice, and I think that's quite interesting, because 75, 76, It's a different era. As you said, the album was actually banned in Jamaica, and I did not know that. So it was first released, legalized. It was first released overseas. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was attempted to be released in Jamaica in 75. And I remember hearing a story where, you know, after they had printed a ton of copies, the police came and confiscated them. You know, they weren't allowed to play anything, any of it on the radio. And so there was a pushback, you know, that really tried to shut down his movement, but he continued and was able to now get a record deal, I believe it's CBS Records. And that's when he was able to kind of introduce the song to the international market.
Yeah. And Doc, maybe you can touch on this too, because this is the first place I heard all the benefits of cannabis, right? Besides sort of a recreational enjoyment, your father's music, you know, it's good right. for tuberculosis, you know, it's for asthma, it's for all these various things. And I remember that, you know, as a youngster.
Standing
but this
out.
Is the first
yeah.
time I heard cannabis in a medical, medicinal way. And that is years ago, way before his time.
Absolutely. It definitely.
And I was just. Yeah.
Spoke to specific, you know, ailments that could be managed and improved with cannabis. So not only going into the spirituality and the wellness of it, but the actual healing property of it. And it promoted, even through Rastafarianism, it promoted a very holistic approach to medical lifestyle and quality and autonomy and choosing your own right and privilege to be able to decide how you want to manage disease. So it was definitely... before its time, it is something that they spoke of through their own truth and fact and saw the benefits of it amongst their family, amongst their friends, individually, personally. And they were able to speak to that and share that message and really raise the awareness for other people to consider it as a medicinal option. So it's beautiful how that transition happened.
Yes, I would totally agree. And Legalize It was, you know, one of the more popular songs. He also had a song like Bush Doctor. There's so many songs where he's kind of, you know, mentioned cannabis and the fight for justice around cannabis. Even with the song Bush Doctor, there's parts where it says, he says it can build up a failing economy. There'll be no more police brutality. You know, he already, you know, a man before his time and cannabis, if we look at the statistics of those that have been targeted by police and our police brutality statistics and, you know, a lot of the more popular cases, so many people, law enforcement has justified police brutality. Mm-hmm. Oh, because I smelled cannabis or I thought, you know, they were selling cannabis or they had possession of cannabis. And so that connection that he was able to make so many years ago, I think is very important for the world to recognize. And, you know, hopefully we're continuing on that path with legalization where there'll be a direct correlation to the police brutality
Absolutely.
Cases that we see within the United States as we legalize.
Great message. Excellent point.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So
cannabis has always served as sort of a yeah. precursor for a stop or yeah. an intervention with anyone on the street. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to touch on something, speaking again about the Peter Tosh legacy and your brother, Gerara McIntosh. Can you talk a little bit about sort of his story and especially the, you know, being a cannabis activist himself and sort of how that story transpired and give a little light on, you know, not only this is obviously significant and important to you, but in sort of this bigger picture, as you just mentioned, legalization, police intervention with the plant, medicinal benefits, et cetera, sort of in this bigger view.
Yeah, definitely. And so Jawara McIntosh, my brother, Peter's youngest son, musically known as Tosh One. He's a follower of Rastafari, a musician, activist, but also a father of four children. And in 2013, he was pulled over in traffic in New Jersey for cannabis. Well, pulled over and arrested for cannabis possession. My, based off of what he's told me personally, you know, I definitely feel like there was racial targeting there, but that's not the gist of the story. And so he was arrested in New Jersey, held for about 3 months without a hearing. So on Father's Day weekend was his arrest, and then he didn't have his initial hearing until September. And even that's just like mind-blowing, because if he was in, you know, probably any other state, I wouldn't say any other state, but some of the more progressive states, you usually have your hearing, you know, shortly after your arrest, if not the next day or after, or a couple days later. And so I initially thought that this would be something that we would put behind us, you know, okay, I just heard about it. I didn't really know the extent of it, but we did, as a family, drive out to New Jersey from Boston, my mom. And that was the first time that we saw him in an orange jumpsuit, you know, handcuffed at his ankles, handcuffed at his feet, kind of dragged into the courtroom. And that's when we heard the prosecution offer a 20-year plea. At that point, I realized it was a lot serious than I could have ever imagined. Fortunately, 3 months later, he was able to make bail. But for about 3 years, from 2013 to 2016, he was back and forth to New Jersey. And each time he went, they would, you know, lower the plea deal and then tell him it's the best offer that they could do. You know, okay, 15 years, you know, you need to take it. You know, look at the track record of, you know, certain judges, they don't play with this. And so he kept having this pressure kind of laid on. And each time he wouldn't accept the plea. And it got to the point where we were really torn. You know, do we stand up for what we believe in as followers of Rastafari, recognizing that this plant has harmed absolutely no one in history, and this is what we recognize as a sacrament? Or, you know, do we risk him being taken out of his children's lives, our lives, for umpteen years? Because, as they would say, if this goes to trial, you know, that just lays on you. Then if this goes to trial, you know, they'll hit you with the full 20 or the full 15. So you want to consider taking this plea. So in 2016, he did decide to take the plea. And by that time, it was down to 5 years. But I remember lawyers saying, like, oh, you'll probably just, you know, get time served. You'll have your hearing next year in June, and you should be released probably at that time. And so we were really expecting him to probably do about 6 months. He turned himself in January of 2017. And then a month later, as we were preparing to go to Jamaica for Reggae Month, my mom calls me frantically. She's crying. And she says, Niambi, there's a surgeon on the phone. They need to perform a life-saving medical procedure on your brother. On Gumel is what we called him. And she just couldn't really have the conversation. And so they wanted me to authorize the surgical procedure. And the doctor told me that he had been attacked by another inmate while incarcerated in Bergen County Jail. And so we authorized the medical procedure, instantly flew to New Jersey, Hackensack Medical Center. And when we got to the hospital to try to go visit him, we were stopped. They told us that you can't visit him. You need to call the jail to get permission to see him. That was, you know, every barrier was just kind of mind-boggling. We've never had an encounter with the criminal justice system before. My brother has had a clean record, you know. And so we called the jail, and they was like, we normally, and with just this attitude, we don't usually let people, you know, visit, you know, that's just not what we do, is what they told us. And honestly, I think it was the name, my father's name, that got us in to see him. And when we walked into the surgical ICU, he had tubes down his throat, a neck brace on, half of his dreads were shaved off, his face was swollen. And he was fighting for his life, and he had handcuffs on his foot, you know, while he was fighting for his life, while being surrounded by correctional officers. And that was the year I quit teaching. That was the year that I knew that I had to really have a new direction and focus in my life to advocate for others. So he actually stayed in the hospital in New Jersey for 3 months in the ICU. We were able to bring him home to Boston for another year and a half. He was in the hospital before bringing him home. And unfortunately, about a year later in 2020 is when he passed away and succumbed to his injuries. He was completely incapacitated from his injuries, not able to kind of talk or anything. From the beginning, it was a traumatic brain injury, but I guess I would say that the silver lining in that journey was when we did bring him home. You know, we turned to the plant to help heal him, and it wasn't until that he started to develop speech, that he, you know, started to become a lot more. From where he started, a lot more capable of just like sustaining eye contact, some of the simplest things that we kind of take for granted. We saw some of that growth happen, but that's when we launched, you know, Justice for Jawara. And my last, you know, it was 2020 was to from 2017 to 2020. I pretty much, you know, spent most of my life by his bedside, not only trying to be an activist, but also advocating for his medical, you know, care. And that was, you know, just a whirlwind of an experience. But my family is very spiritual. You know, that we continue to share his story with the hopes that people understand. You know, we hear like war on drugs, or we hear, you know, ex-cons and these terminologies that really dehumanize people that have gone through this experience, or just jargon, you know, and we want people to know that, you know, cannabis prohibition doesn't affect just an individual. It affects a family. Yeah. It impacts a community. It's a lot more than just a term that is just kind of thrown around loosely.
The entire family goes to jail when one person suffers. Has to go to jail. Everyone, you know, from the phone calls, from the cost, from the you know, losing of the interaction with the children. It's a long-standing bleeding problem into our entire family, and I know firsthand as well too. I can tell you from the medical perspective, working at that particular hospital, Hackensack, you know, we receive a lot of inmates, and it was exactly how you described it. Family was not allowed to visit because you're technically still in custody. So they were not allowed to see their sons and their fathers and their uncles. They were not allowed to visit, regardless if it's a terminal, you know, situation or not. So that is amazing that you were able to be by his side during that most critical time, and the environment that's created, watching him handcuffed to an ICU bed, you know, feet are shackled with at least 3 correctional officers, like he can actually get out of bed and go anywhere. That's exactly what the scenario looks like, and it's a horrible memory. I'm glad you were able to bring him closer to home and be able to heal him as best as you could, you know, with your own family prayer and your own power of the plant. And I know that helped with his neurological improvement through the traumatic brain injury, but also his physical pain and just numbness and spasms that he was going through, and unable to communicate, and trying to, you know, really be his advocate and speak for him and really leave a great legacy and impression for his children, because that's what they need. Those memories are what they need of their father. So that's a lot. It's absolutely a lot. And I can tell you, I've seen it. I've been there. I'm an ER physician, and I trained at Morristown Medical Center and Hackensack. I worked there previously. Wow. So it's a terrible last fitting memory. I'll tell you for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely, definitely. To hear that story, it's just tough to even hear that story. So I can't imagine, you know, to even experience something like that. And unfortunately, it all stemmed from the criminalization of cannabis. Again, connecting back to something your father spoke about, you know, decades ago, legalize it. So talk about, you touched on that a little bit. Again, did you felt that whole situation really sort of pushed you forward in more of an activist role and sort of making it a top priority, this movement to legalize and do various things in this cannabis movement?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, I had the privilege of not really having to encounter the criminal justice system. And so it's one of those things that you really don't know how bad it is until you experience it. And I knew from the moment that I saw him, I remember just like ending I'm like, okay, I got to quit this job. Like everything was just, I was like, I have to do this. Yeah, I cannot like live on in a normal way and know that there's work to be done. And so it definitely kind of just helped me to kind of redirect where I found
purpose. It propelled you into that position. You know, sometimes we are destined for things that we don't even realize that's our purpose and our goals. So this personal impact, long-lasting legacy, you've always had this surrounding you, your father's foundation and his principles and his, you know, his inspiration to the world. But that particular situation with Gerard seemed like that is what really helped you to transition and walk into your light for where you are today and how you present today, which is, I know he's smiling on you and I know he's proud of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And yeah, it's definitely that whole experience. I would agree that now just, you know, as bitter as it was, I continue to, you know, through our faith in Rastafari and just like give thanks. I think at the end of the day, no matter what trials and tribulations that we go through, we have to wake up every morning and give thanks for life and know that every experience, good, bad, or indifferent, serves a purpose, you know, in our life and helps us to get closer to our true destiny.
Here we are in 2021. California is the only state that has now allowed medical cannabis into the hospitals for terminally ill patients and patients who are on hospice. So, and that's the only state out of all the states that are recreational and medicinal. California was the first last year to allow patients who are actually on a hospital campus to use cannabis if they're determined to have traumatic and long-term terminal illness. So hopefully that is something that can be, you know, acknowledged nationwide because it's necessary. It's necessary to have that choice at least.
It definitely. I would say that oftentimes we look at cannabis as a kind of a last resort when we really should be looking at it as a first, because of its, you know, natural properties and is not often tied to severe side effects that we often see in the commercials, you know. So I think I recently heard that, but I didn't know it was the only state. It kind of shows that although legalization, we're on this kind of wave, there's so much work to be done in kind of this nitty gritty space that people don't necessarily always think of, you know? And so, you know, that work is, we have a lot more work to do.
And talk a little bit about some of the organizations, obviously the Peter Tosh Foundation and things of that nature, but talk to us a little bit about your work with the Last Prisoner Project and Minorities for Medical Marijuana.
Yeah, so I'm on the board of directors for Minorities for Medical Marijuana. And, you know, our relationship started kind of shortly after they heard about my brother's story. And we are an organization that has 25 chapters in different states, including Toronto and the UK and Jamaica. And the goal really for the nonprofit is to really be that nationwide global activist for an advocate for people of color. It doesn't really exist. We have, you know, over 1,000 members, and we continue to not only advocate and help with legislation and laws and making sure that we are included, you know, at the table where these conversations are happening. But we have various programs. So we have a boot camp, a licensed boot camp, where we're really helping to get people into the cannabis industry. I've also worked with them on Project Clean Slate, which is an expungement clinics that we do around the country. And also to include wraparound services, because it's not only just getting people's expungements, their criminal records expunged, yeah, but there's so many services that people need, from housing to to just even getting a license. You know, there's so many simple things that, as again I say, until you've experienced it, you really take those things for granted. We also work with HBCUs, and so we have a program, Ready, Set, Grow, where we're working with historically Black colleges and setting up internships with cannabis programs and companies. So there's a lot of work that we do with M4MM. And then I'm also on the advisory board for Last Prisoner Project. And they have been a great partner in allowing me to kind of share my story about Jawara, and you know, have that kind of national platform to do so, but also supporting them in a lot of the initiatives. There still are many cannabis prisoners within the country, and LPP really works on a global level as well to really learn how to get cannabis prisoners released. And now they've added some programs that help support the families of cannabis prisoners. That's a major need, because as you mentioned, it's not just the individual, but it's really the family that suffers when someone is taken out of the community in that way. And so they also offer a lot of programs to help support the children of cannabis prisoners. And so they continue to do work, and really we are writing policy and helping to look at supporting legalization efforts that are inclusive of those that have been impacted by the war on drugs.
Nyambi, what's next for you? What's coming up next for Nyambi McIntosh? Tell us about your 2022 goals and plans and what we can anticipate.
Wow. Well, right now we are continuing to work on the Peter Tosh cannabis brand. And so Seen by Peter Tosh is a brand that, you know, we have taken our time to really enter into this market. I think that it's been an interesting space, you know, for brands to live in. And it was really important that we, like I mentioned, we had that foundation, literally and figuratively, to build on. And so we're looking forward to really launching the cannabis brand this year. And that's part of our main focus, and celebrating International Peter Tosh Day again, you know, come April 20.
We're excited.
Love it. Seen is dropping this year. We're going to see the product rolled out. No pun intended.
Yes,
or pun
yes,
intended.
Yes. Rolled out, rolled up, and smoked.
right. But this season, we was focused on Free the Culture, and we just wanted to get your thoughts on, what does Free the Culture mean to you?
Free to culture. You know, for me, were you about to say something? For me, it really just, it means, you know, an opportunity for culture to thrive. I think that in so many spaces, culture has been kind of taken out of what we tend to promote. There's always been this, like, more corporate and I would say Eurocentric focus. And so I think that now there's been so many opportunities for us to speak and love and embrace our culture and promote it on various platforms. So for me, that's what Free to Culture means.
I love it. Any last words,
Doc?
Man,
this has been a heavy one. This interview has taught me a lot. just listening to the journey of your father and learning that his music was initially banned in his own homeland, to finally gaining international recognition, to losing him at such a young age and really relying on the family history and the legacy and the stories from all the beautiful people that interacted with him personally and professionally throughout his years to help create your memories and really infuse the foundation of what he practiced into your well-being and your lifestyle, and then being propelled into this position of advocacy that you absolutely always had a calling to do and were able to see it through the work of your family and through the work of your brother and the urgency and need to make sure that this is legalized and doesn't happen to anyone else. Your journey has been inspirational and incredible, and it's one of passion, one of care. It's such a delicate process. And hopefully you're able to really pass on these words of wisdom to your daughter and your family's children. And it's a legacy that will continue to live far beyond, you know, what we're doing right now. And they'll be able to have the foresight to grow it into something greater than we could have ever imagined. So we're happy to finally sit down with you. We're happy to learn more about you individually and what you're doing for your family and your father's namesake. And it's been a beautiful process. So thank you for sharing, and thank you for being honest, and thank you for being vulnerable. And it's I know it was really hard and challenging to speak to today, but we appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm so glad that we were finally able to connect. It's been a pleasure being on the show.
Great. Beautifully said, Doc. Thank you so much for joining us. Love the conversation. This is Leaf Style, no longer a subculture.
Yay!
A Leaf Style.
Thank you, Niambi.